The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 2, continued.
Cassette 8, Side 1.
Weakened from interrogation, gripped by the cold, you have a very hard time holding it, women especially. Well, and so what? It's for horses to stand stock still and loose the floodgates. It's for dogs to go lift a leg against a fence. But as for people, you can do it right there while you keep moving. No need to be shy in your own fatherland. It will dry at the transit prison. Vera Konyeva stooped down to adjust her shoe and fell one step behind, and the convoy immediately set the police dog on her, and the dog bit her in the buttocks through all her winter clothing. Don't fall behind! And an Uzbek fell down, and they beat him with their gunstocks and jackboots. Well, that's no tragedy. It won't be photographed for the Daily Express. And the chief of convoy will live to a ripe old age and never be tried by anyone. And the Black Marias, too, came down to us from history. In what respect does the prison carriage described by Balzac differ from a Black Maria? Only that the prison carriage was drawn along more slowly and prisoners weren't packed so tightly. True, in the 20s, columns of prisoners were still being driven afoot through our cities, even Leningrad. They brought traffic to a halt at intersections. So you got caught stealing, came the reproaches from the sidewalks. No one had yet grasped the great plan for sewage disposal. But, always alert to technological trends, the archipelago lost no time in adopting the Black Ravens, more familiarly known simply as Ravens, Black Marias. These first Black Marias appeared at the same time as the very first trucks on our still cobblestoned streets. Their suspension was poor, and it was very rough riding in them, but then the prisoners weren't made of crystal either. On the other hand, they were very tightly corked, even at that time, in 1927. There wasn't one little crack, and there wasn't one little electric light bulb, and there wasn't any air to breathe, and it was impossible to see out. And even in those days, they stood so tightly packed inside that there wasn't any room left at all. And it wasn't that all this was intentionally planned. There simply weren't enough wheels to go around. For many years, the Black Marias were steel grey and had, so to speak, prison written all over them. But in the biggest cities after the war, they had second thoughts and decided to paint them bright colours and to write on the outside, bread. The prisoners were the bread of construction. Or meat, it would have been more accurate to write bones. Or even simply, drink Soviet champagne. Inside, the Black Marias might consist of a simple armored body or shell, an empty enclosure. Or perhaps there were benches against the walls all the way around. This was in no sense a convenience, but the reverse. They would push in just as many prisoners as could be inserted standing up. But in this case, they would be piled on top of each other like baggage, one bale on another. The Black Maria might also have a box in the rear, a narrow steel closet for one prisoner. Or it might be boxed throughout, single closets that locked like cells along the right and left-hand walls, with a corridor in the middle for the turnkey. One was hardly likely to imagine that interior like a honeycomb when looking at that laughing maiden on the outside, drink Soviet champagne. They drive you into the Black Marias to the tune of the same shouts coming from the convoy from all sides at once. Come on there, get a move on quick! And so that you shouldn't have time to look around and figure out how to escape, you are shoved and pushed so that you and your bag get stuck in a narrow little door, and you knock your head against the lintel. The steel rear door slams shut with a bang, and off you go. It was rare, of course, to spend hours in a Black Maria. 20 to 30 minutes were more likely. But you got flung around. It was a bone breaker. It crushed all your insides during those half hours. Your head stooped, if you were tall. And you remembered the cozy stolypin with longing. And the Black Maria means one thing further. It is a reshuffling of the deck, new encounters. And among them, those which stand out most clearly are, of course, your encounters with the thieves. You may never happen to be in the same compartment with them, and maybe they won't put you in the same cell with them, even at the transit prison. But here in the Black Maria, you are in their hands. Sometimes it is so crowded that even the thieves, the urki, find it awkward to filch. Your legs and your arms are clamped between your neighbors' bodies and bags as tightly as if they were in stocks. Only when all of you are tossed up and down and all your insides are shaken up by ruts and bumps can you change the position of your legs and arms. Sometimes, in less crowded circumstances, the thieves can check out the contents of all the bags in just half an hour and appropriate all the bacilli, the fats and goodies, and the best of the trash, the clothing. Cowardly and sensible considerations most likely restrain you from putting up a fight against them, and crumb by crumb you are already beginning to lose your immortal soul, still supposing that the main enemies and the main issues lie somewhere ahead, and that you must save yourself for them. And you might just throw a punch at them once and get a knife in the ribs then and there. There would be no investigation, and even if there should be one, it wouldn't threaten the thieves in any way. They would only be delayed at the transit prison instead of going to the far-off camp. You must concede that in a fight between a socially friendly prisoner and a socially hostile prisoner, the state simply could not be on the side of the latter. In 1946, retired Colonel Lunin, a high-ranking official in Osoyavyakhim, the Society for Assistance to Defense and to Aviation Chemical Construction of the USSR, recounted in a Butyrki cell how the thieves in a Moscow Black Maria on March the 8th, International Women's Day, during their transit from the city court to Taganka prison, gang-raped a young bride in his presence, and amid the silent passivity of everyone else in the van. That very morning the girl had come to her trial a free person, as attractively dressed as she could manage. She was on trial for leaving her work without official permission, which in itself was a repulsive fabrication worked up by her chief in revenge for her refusal to live with him. A half hour before the Black Maria, the girl had been sentenced to 5 years under the decree, and had then been shoved into this Black Maria. And right there, in broad daylight, somewhere on the park ring, drink Soviet champagne, had been turned into a camp prostitute. And are we really to say that it was the thieves who did this to her, and not the jailers, and not her chief? And thief tenderness, too. Having raped her, they robbed her. They took the fashionable shoes with which she had hoped to charm the judges, and her blouse, which they shoved through to the convoy guards, who stopped the van and went off to get some vodka and handed it in so the thieves could drink at her expense, too. And when they got to the Taganka prison, the girl sobbed out her complaint, and the officer listened to her, yawned, and said, "The government can't provide each of you with individual transportation. We don't have such facilities." Yes, the Black Marias are a bottleneck of the archipelago, if there is no possibility of separating the politicals from the criminals and the Stolypins, then it isn't possible to keep women separate from men in the Black Marias. And just how could one expect the thieves not to live it up en route from one jail to another? Well, and if it weren't for the thieves, we would have to be grateful to the Black Marias for our brief encounters with women. Where, if not here, is one to see them, hear them, and touch them in a prison existence? Once, in 1950, they were transporting us from the Butyrki to the station in a not-at-all crowded van, 14 people in a Black Maria with benches. Everyone sat down, and suddenly they pushed in one more, a woman, alone. She sat down beside the rear door, fearfully at first. After all, she was totally defenseless against 14 men in a dark cell. But it became clear, after a few words, that all those present were comrades. 58. She gave us her name, Repina, a colonel's wife, and she had been arrested right after he had. And suddenly a silent military man, so young and thin that it seemed he had to be a lieutenant, said to her, "Tell me, weren't you arrested with Antonina I? What, are you her husband? Oleg? Yes, Lieutenant Colonel I, from the Funza Academy? Yes." What a yes that was. It emerged from a trembling throat, and in it there was more fear of finding out something bad than there was happiness. He sat down next to her. Twilight shafts of summer daylight, diffused through two microscopic gratings in the two rear doors, flickered around the interior as the van moved along and across the faces of the woman and the lieutenant colonel. She and I were imprisoned in the same cell for 4 months while she was undergoing interrogation. Where is she now? All that time she lived only for you. Her fears weren't for herself, but were all for you. First that they shouldn't arrest you, and then later that you should get a lighter sentence. But what has happened to her now? She blamed herself for your arrest. Things were so hard for her. Where is she now? Just don't be frightened. And Rapina put her hands on his chest as if he were her own skin. She simply couldn't endure the strain. They took her away from us. She, you know, became, well, a little confused. You understand? And that tiny storm, boxed in sheets of steel, rolled along so peacefully in the six-lane automobile traffic, stopped at traffic lights and signaled for a turn. I had met Oleg I and the Butyrki just a few moments before, and here is how it happened. They had herded us into the station box and had brought us our things from the storage room. They called him and me to the door at the same moment. Through the opened door into the corridor, we could see a woman jailer rifling the contents of his suitcase, and she flung out of it and onto the floor a golden shoulder board with the stars of a lieutenant colonel that had survived until then all by itself. Heaven only knows how. She herself hadn't noticed it, and she had accidentally stepped on its big stars with her foot. She had trampled it with her shoe, exactly as in a film shot. I said to him, "Direct your attention to that, comrade lieutenant colonel." And he glowered. After all, he still had his ideas about the spotlessness of the service. And now, here was the next thing, about his wife. And he had had only 1 hour to fit all this in. Chapter 2. The Ports of the Archipelago. Spread out on a large table, the enormous map of our motherland indicate with fat black dots all provincial capitals, all railroad junctions, all transfer points where the railroad line ends in a river route, and where rivers bend and trails begin. What is this? Has the entire map been speckled by infectious flies? What it is, in fact, is precisely the majestic map of the ports of the archipelago. These are not, to be sure, the enchanted ports to which Alexander Grin enticed us, where rum is drunk in taverns and men pay court to beautiful women. It is a rare Zek who was not known from 3 to 5 transit prisons and camps. Many remember a dozen or so, and the sons of Gulag can count up to 50 of them without the slightest difficulty. However, in memory, they get all mixed up together because they are so similar in the illiteracy of their convoys, in their inept roll calls based on case files, the long waiting under the beating sun or autumn drizzle, the still longer body searches that involve undressing completely, their haircuts with unsanitary clippers, their cold, slippery baths, their foul-smelling toilets, their damp and moldy corridors, their perpetually crowded, nearly always dark, wet cells, the warmth of human flesh flanking you on the floor or on the board bunks, the bumpy ridges of bunk heads knocked together from boards, the wet, almost liquid bread, the gruel cooked from what seemed to be silage. And whoever has a good, sharp memory and can recollect precisely what distinguishes one from another has no need to travel about the country because he knows its geography full well on the basis of transit prisons. Novosibirsk, I know it, I was there. Very strong barracks there made from thick beams. Irkutsk, that was where the windows had been bricked over in several stages. You could see how they had been in Tsarist times, and each course had been laid separately, and only small slits had been left between them. Vologda, yes, an ancient building with towers, the toilets right on top of one another, the wooden partitions rotten, and the ones above leaking down into the ones underneath. Uzman, of course, a lice-ridden, stinking hole of a jail, an ancient vaulted structure, and there they used to pack it so full that whenever they took prisoners out for a transport, you couldn't imagine where they'd put them all, a line strung out halfway through the city. You had better not tell such a connoisseur that you know some city without a transit prison. He will prove to you conclusively that there are no such cities, and he will be right. Salsk. Well, there they keep transit prisoners in the KPZ, cells for preliminary detention, along with prisoners under interrogation. And what do you mean, no transit prison in every district center, too? In Solyesk? Of course there's one. In Rybinsk? What about prison number two, a former monastery? It's a quiet one, too, with the empty courtyards paved with old mossy flagstones and clean wooden tubs in the bath. In Chita, prison number one. In Naushki, not a prison, but a transit camp, which is the same thing. In Torzhok, up the hill, also in a monastery.
You must realize, dear sir, that every town has to have its own transit prison. After all, the courts operate everywhere. And how are prisoners to be delivered to camp? By air? Of course, no transit prison is the equal of another, but which is better and which worse is something that can't be settled in an argument. If three or four zeks get together, each of them feels bound to praise his own. Let us listen for a while to such a discussion. Well, even if the Ivanovo transit prison isn't one of the more famous, my friends, just ask anybody imprisoned there in the winter of 1937 to 1938. The prison was unheated, and the prisoners not only didn't freeze to death, but on the upper bunks they lay there undressed, and they knocked out all the window panes so as not to suffocate. Instead of the 20 men cell 21 was supposed to contain, there were 323. There was water underneath the bunks, and boards were laid in the water, and people lay on those boards. That was right where the frost poured in from the broken windows. It was like Arctic night down under the bunks. There was no light down there either, because it was cut off by the people lying on the bunks above and standing in the aisle. It was impossible to walk through the aisle to the latrine tank, and people crawled along the edges of the bunks. They didn't distribute rations to individuals, but to units of 10. If one of the 10 died, the others shoved his corpse under the bunks and kept it there until it started to stink. They got the corpse's ration. And all that could have been endured, but the turnkeys seemed to have been oiled with turpentine, and they kept driving the prisoners endlessly from cell to cell, on and on. You just get yourself settled when, come on, get a move on, you're being moved, and you'd have to start in again, trying to find a place. And the reason for such overcrowding was that they hadn't taken anyone to the bath for 3 months. The lice had multiplied, and people had abscesses from the lice on their feet and legs, and typhus, too. And because of the typhus, the prison was quarantined, and no prisoner transports could leave it for 4 months. Well, fellows, the problem there wasn't Ivanovo, but the year, in 1937 to 1938, of course, not just the zeks, but the very stones of the transit prisons were screaming in agony. Irkutsk was no special transit prison either, but in 1938 the doctors didn't even dare look into the cells, but would walk down the corridor while a turnkey shouted through the door, "Anyone unconscious, come out!" In 1937, fellows, it was that way all across Siberia to the Kolyma, and the big bottleneck was in the Sea of Okhotsk and in Vladivostok. The steamships could transport only 30,000 a month, and they kept driving them on and on from Moscow without taking that into account. Well, and so 100,000 of them piled up, understand? Who counted them? Whoever was supposed to, counted. If you're talking about the Vladivostok transit prison, then in February 1937 there weren't more than 40,000 there. People were stuck there for several months at a time. The bedbugs infested the board bunks like locusts. Half a mug of water a day, there wasn't any more. No one to haul it. There was one whole compound of Koreans, and they all died from dysentery, every last one of them. They took 100 corpses out of our own compound every morning. They were building a morgue, so they hitched the zeks to the carts and hauled the stone that way. Today you do the hauling, and tomorrow they haul you there yourself. And in autumn the typhus arrived, and we did the same thing. We didn't hand over the corpses till they stank, and took the extra rations. No medication, whatever. We crawled to the fence and begged, "Give us medicine," and the guards fired a volley from the watchtowers. Then they assembled those with typhus in a separate barracks. Some didn't make it there, and only a few came back. The bunks there had two stories, and anyone on an upper who was sick and running a fever wasn't able to clamber down to go to the toilet, and so it would all pour down on the people underneath. There were 1,500 sick there, and all the orderlies were thieves. They'd pull out the gold teeth from the corpses, and not only from the corpses. Why do you keep going on and on about 1937? What about 1949 on Vanino Bay in the fifth compound? What about that? There were 35,000, and for several months, too. There was another bottleneck in transport to the Kolyma,
And every night, for some reason, they kept driving people from one barracks to another and from one compound to another, just as it was with the fascists. Whistles, screams. Come on out there, without the last one. Without the last one, a menacing command to be understood literally. It meant, I will kill the last man. Literally, or at least warm his hide with a club. And so all piled out so as not to be last. And everyone went on the run, always on the run. They'd drive 100 to get bread, on the run, for gruel, on the run. No bowls to eat from, take the gruel in whatever you could, the flap of your coat, your hands. They brought water in big tanks, and there was nothing to distribute it in, so they shot it out in sprays, and whoever could get his mouth in front of one got some. Prisoners began to fight in front of the tanks, and the guards fired on them from the towers, exactly like under the fascists. Major General Derevyenko, the chief of administration of the Northeast, that is Kolyma, corrective labor camps, came, and while he was there, an Air Force aviator stepped out in front of the crowd and ripped his field shirt down the front. I have 7 battle decorations. Who gave you the right to shoot into the compound? And Derevyanko replied, we shot and we will go on shooting until you learn how to behave. Say there, Bertrand Russell's War Crimes Tribunal, why don't you use this bit of material? Or doesn't it suit you? No, boys, none of those are real transit prisons. Now take Kirov, that was a real one. Let's not take any special year, but say 1947. Even then in Kirov, 2 turnkeys had to work together with their boots to jam people into a cell, that being the only way they could get the door shut. In September, and Kirov, formerly Vyatka, isn't on the Black Sea either, everyone was sitting naked on the 3-story bunks because of the heat. They were sitting because there was no place to lie down. 1 row sat at the heads of the bunks and 1 row at the feet. And 2 rows sat on the floor in the aisle, and others stood between them, and they took turns. They kept their knapsacks in their hands or on their knees because there was nowhere to put them down. Only the thieves were in their lawful places, the 2nd-story bunks next to the windows, and they spread out as they pleased. There were so many bed bugs that they went right on biting in the daytime, and they dive-bombed straight from the ceiling. And people had to suffer through that for a week or even a month. I myself would like to interrupt in order to tell about Krasnaya Preznya in August 1945 in the Victory Summer. But I am shy. This transit prison with its glorious revolutionary name is little known to Muscovites. There are no excursions to it, and how could there be when it is still in operation? But to get a close look at it, you don't have to travel any distance at all. It's a mere stone's throw from the Novokhoroshevo highway on the Circle Line. After all, in Krasnaya Preznya, we could somehow stretch out our legs at night, and the bed bugs were moderate, and flies bit us all night long as we lay naked and sweaty under the bright lights. But of course that's nothing at all, and I would be ashamed to boast about it. We streamed with sweat every time we moved, and it simply poured out of us after we ate. There were 100 of us in a cell, a little larger than the average room in an apartment, and we were packed in, and you couldn't find a place on the floor for your feet. And 2 little windows on the south side were blocked with muzzles made of steel sheets. They not only kept the air from circulating, but they got very hot from the sun and radiated heat into the cell. Just as all transit prisons are pointless, talk about transit prisons is pointless, and in all probability, this chapter too will turn out to be the same. One doesn't know what to take hold of first, what particular thing to talk about, what to lead off with. And the more people that are crowded into transit prisons, the more pointless it all becomes. It is unbearable for a human being, and it is inexpedient for Gulag, but people sit there month after month. And the transit prison becomes a straight factory. Bread rations are lugged in, stacked up in hand barrows like those in which bricks are hauled, and the steaming gruel is brought in 6 bucket wooden casks that have holes knocked in them with a crowbar. The transit prison at Kotlas was tenser and more above board than many, tenser because it opened the way to the whole northeast of European Russia, and more above board because it was already deep in the archipelago, and there was no need to pretend to anybody. It was simply a piece of land divided into cages by fencing, and the cages were all kept locked. although it had been thickly settled by peasants when they were exiled in 1930, one must realize that they had no roofs over their heads, but nobody is left to tell about it. Even in 1938, there simply wasn't room for everyone in the frail one-story wooden barracks made of discarded end pieces of lumber and covered with tarpaulin. Under the wet autumn snow and in freezing temperatures, people simply lived there on the ground beneath the heavens. True, they weren't allowed to grow numb from inactivity. They were being counted endlessly. They were invigorated by checkups. 20,000 people were there at a time. Or by sudden night searches. Later on, tents were pitched in these cages, and log houses 2 stories high were built in some of them. But to reduce the construction costs sensibly, no floor was laid between the stories. 6-story bunks with step ladders were simply built into the sides, up and down which prisoners on their last legs, on the verge of dying, had to clamber like sailors. A structure which would have adorned a ship more appropriately than a port. In the winter of 1944 to 1945, when everyone had a roof over his head, there was room for only 7,500 prisoners, and 50 of them died every day, and the stretchers on which they were carried to the morgue were never idle. People will object that this was quite acceptable, a death rate of less than 1% per day, and that, given that sort of turnover, it might manage to last 5 months. Yes, but the main killer was camp labor, and that hadn't even begun yet for transit prisoners. This loss of 2/3 of 1% per day represents sheer shrinkage, and it would be intolerably high even in some vegetable warehouses. The deeper into the archipelago one got, the more obviously did the concrete docks of the archipelago become transformed into wharves made of wooden pilings. In the course of several years, 500,000 people passed through Karabas, the transit camp near Karaganda, whose name became a byword in the language. Yuri Karbe was there in 1942 and was already registered in the 433rd thousand. The transit prison consisted of low, rammed earth barracks with earthen floors. Daily recreation there consisted in driving all the prisoners out with their things and putting artists to work whitewashing the floor and even painting carpets on it. And then in the evenings the zecs would lie down on it and their bodies would rub out both the whitewash and the carpet. Of all the transit prisons, Karabas was worthiest of becoming a museum. But alas, it no longer exists. In its place, there is a factory for reinforced concrete products. The Knyaz Pogost transit point, latitude 63 degrees north, consisted of shacks built on a swamp. Their pole frames were covered with torn tarpaulin tenting that didn't quite reach the ground. The double bunks inside them were also made of poles, from which, incidentally, the branches had been only partially removed, and the aisle was floored with poles also. During the day, the wet mud squelched through the flooring, and at night it froze. In various parts of the area, the walkways were laid on frail and shaky poles, and here and there, people whom weakness had made clumsy fell into the water and ooze. In 1938, they fed the prisoners in Knyaz Pogost the same thing every day, a mash made of crushed grits and fish bones. This was convenient because there were no bowls, spoons, or forks at the transit prison, and the prisoners had none of their own either. They were herded to the boiler by the dozens, and the mash was ladled into their caps or the flaps of their jackets. And in the transit prison of Vogvozdino, several miles from Ust-Vim, where 5,000 prisoners were kept at a time. Now, whoever heard of Vogvozdino before this sentence? How many such unknown transit prisons were there, and then multiply that by 5,000? The food was liquid, but they had no bowls either. However, they managed without them. What is there that our Russian ingenuity cannot overcome? By distributing the gruel in wash basins for 10 people at a time, leaving them to race each other, gulping it down. Galina Serebryakova, Boris Dyakov, Alan Semyonov, did you ever gulp from a wash basin 10 at a time? And if you had, you would never, of course, have descended to the animal needs of Ivan Denisovich, would you? And in the midst of the mob scene at the wash basin, you would have continued to think only about your dear party? true, no one was imprisoned in Vojvodina longer than a year. The kind of prisoner who would have been imprisoned there that long was a prisoner on his last legs whom all the camps had refused to accept. The imagination of writers is poverty-stricken in regard to the native life and customs of the archipelago. When they want to write about the most reprehensible and disgraceful aspect of prison, they always accuse the latrine bucket. In literature, the latrine bucket has become the symbol of prison, a symbol of humiliation, of stink. Oh, how frivolous can you be? Now, was the latrine bucket really an evil for the prisoner? On the contrary, it was the most merciful device of the prison administration. The actual horror began the moment there was no latrine bucket in the cell. In 1937, there were no latrine buckets in certain Siberian prisons, or there weren't enough. Not enough of them had been made ahead of time. Siberian industry hadn't caught up with the full scope of arrests. There were no latrine barrels in the warehouses for the newly created cells. There were old latrine buckets in the cells, but they were antiquated and small, and the only reasonable thing to do at that point was to remove them, since they amounted to nothing at all for the new reinforcements of prisoners. So if, long ago, the Minusinsk prison had been built for 500 people, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin was never inside it. He moved about freely. And there were now 10,000 in it. It meant that each latrine bucket ought to have become 20 times bigger. But it had not. Our Russian pens write only in large letters. We have lived through so very much, and almost none of it has been described and called by its right name. But for Western authors, peering through a microscope at the living cells of everyday life, shaking a test tube in the beam of a strong light, this is, after all, a whole epic, another 10 volumes of remembrance of things past. To describe the perturbation of a human soul placed in a cell filled to 20 times its capacity and with no latrine bucket, where prisoners are taken out to the toilet only once a day. Of course, much of the texture of this life is bound to be quite unknown to Western writers. They wouldn't realize that in this situation one solution was to urinate in your canvas hood, nor would they at all understand one prisoner's advice to another to urinate in his boot. And yet, that advice was the fruit of wisdom derived from vast experience, and it didn't involve spoiling the boot, and it didn't reduce the boot to the status of a pail. It meant that the boot had to be taken off, turned upside down, the boot tops turned inside out and up, and thus a cylindrical vessel was formed that constituted the much-needed container. But at the same time, with what psychological twists and turns Western writers could enrich their literature, without in the least risking any banal repetition of the famous masters, if they only knew about the scheme of things in that same Minusinsk prison. There was only one food bowl for every 4 prisoners, and 1 mug of drinking water per day was issued to each. There were enough mugs to go around. And it could happen that 1 of the 4 contrived to use the bowl allotted to him and 3 others to relieve his internal pressure, and then refused to hand over his daily water ration to wash it out before lunch. What a conflict, what a clash of 4 personalities, what nuances. And I'm not joking, that is when the rock bottom of a human being is revealed. It is only that Russian pens are too busy to write about it, and Russian eyes don't have time to read about it. I am not joking, because only doctors can tell us how months in such a cell will ruin a human being's health for his entire life, even if he wasn't shot under Yezhov and was rehabilitated under Khrushchev. And just to think that we had dreamed of resting and loosening up a bit in port, after being squashed and doubled up for several days in the Stolypin, how we had dreamed of the transit prison, that we could stretch out a bit there and straighten up, that we would be able to go to the toilet there without hurrying, that we would drink as much water there as we wanted and get as much hot water for tea, that there we wouldn't be forced to ransom our own bread rations from the convoy with our own belongings, that we would be fed hot food there, and that at last we would be taken to the bath, that we could drench ourselves in hot water and stop itching. We had had elbows stuck into our sides and been tossed from side to side in the Black Maria, and they had shouted at us, "Link arms! Take hold of your heels!" But we were in good spirits anyway. It was all right, all right. Soon we would be at the transit prison. And now we were there. And even if some part of our dreams came true in the transit prison, something else would foul it all up anyway. What awaits us in the bath? You can never be sure. They begin suddenly to shave all the women's hair off. In Krasnaya Preznia in November 1950. Or a line of us naked men is clipped by women barbers only. In the Vologda steam room, portly Aunt Motya used to shout, "Stand up, men!" And she'd let the whole line have it from the steam pipe. And the Irkutsk transit prison argued differently. It's more natural for the entire service staff in the bath to be male, and for a man to smear on the medicinal tar ointment between the women's legs. Or, during the winter, in the cold, soaping up room of the Novosibirsk transit prison, only cold water comes from the faucets. The prisoners make up their minds to ask higher ups, and a captain comes, puts his own hand unfastidiously under a faucet. "I say, this water is hot. Get it?" I have already wearied of reporting that there are baths which have no water at all, that they scorch clothes in the roaster, that after the bath they compel people to run naked and barefoot through the snow to get their things. The counterintelligence of the second Byelorussian front in Brodnica in 1945. From your very first steps in the transit prison, you realize that here you are not in the hands of the jailers or the officers of the prison administration, who at least adhere some of the time to some kind of written law. Here you are in the hands of the trustees, that surly bath attendant who comes to meet your prisoner transport. "Well, go wash, gentlemen fascists." And that work assignment clerk with a plywood writing board who looks over your formation searchingly and hurries you up. And that instructor, clean-shaven except for a prominent forelock, who slaps his leg with that rolled-up newspaper and at the same time gives your bags a once-over. And then other transit prison trustees whom you don't recognize penetrate your suitcases with X-ray eyes. Oh, how alike they all are. And where in your brief prisoner transport journey have you seen them all before? Not so clean-looking, not so well-washed, but the same kind of ugly mug swine with pitiless, bare-toothed grins. Bah! These are the same blatnye, the thieves again, those same urki crooks whom Leonid Utyosov glorifies in his songs. Here again are Zhenka Zhogol, Serioga Zver, and Dimka Kishkenya, but not behind bars this time. They have been cleaned up, dressed up as representatives of the state. And putting on airs of great importance, they see to it that discipline is observed by us. And if one peers into those snouts, one can even, with imagination, picture that they sprang from the same Russian roots as the rest of us, that once upon a time they were village boys whose fathers bore such names as Klim, Prokhor, Guri, and that their general structure is even similar to our own: two nostrils, two irises in the eyes, a rosy tongue with which to swallow food and utter certain Russian sounds, which, however, shape totally new words. Every chief of a transit prison has enough presence of mind to realize that he can send his relatives back home the wages for all staff positions, or else he can divvy them up with the other prison officers. And all you have to do is whistle to get as many volunteers as you want from among the socially friendly prison elements, to carry out all that work just in return for being allowed to cast anchor at the transit prison and not have to go on to a mine or to the taiga. All these work assignment clerks, office clerks, bookkeepers, instructors, bath attendants, barbers, stockroom clerks, cooks, dishwashers, laundresses, tailors who repair underwear and linens, are permanent transit prison residents. They receive prison rations and are registered in cells, and they swipe the rest of their soup and chow on their own out of the common food pot, or out of the bundles of the transit zecs. All these transit prison trustees regarded as certain that they will never be better off in any camp. We arrive in their hands, still not completely plucked, and they bamboozle us to their heart's content. It is they, and not the jailers, who search us and our belongings here, and before the search they suggest we turn in our money for safekeeping. And they seriously write down a list. We never see the list or the money again. "We turned in our money." "Who to?" the officer who has arrived on the scene asks in surprise. "Well, it was one of them." "Who exactly?" The trustees hadn't noticed which one. "Why did you turn it over to him?" "We thought..." "That's what the turkey thought. Think less and you'll be better off." And that's that. They suggest we leave our things in the vestibule to the bath. No one's going to take them. Who needs them? We leave them, for after all, we can't take them into the bath with us anyway. We return, and there are no sweaters left, and no fur-lined mittens. What kind of a sweater was it? Greyish. Well, that means it went to the laundry. They also take things from us honestly, in return for taking a suitcase into the storage room for safekeeping, for putting us in a cell without the thieves, for sending us off on prisoner transports as soon as possible, for not sending us off as long as possible. The only thing they don't do is rob us by main force out in the open. But those aren't thieves, the connoisseurs among us explain. These are the bitches, the ones who work for the prison. They are enemies of the honest thieves, and the honest thieves are the ones imprisoned in cells. But somehow this is hard for our rabbity brains to grasp. Their ways are the same. They have the same kind of tattoos. Maybe they really are enemies of those others, but after all, they are not our friends either. That's how it is. And by this time, they have forced us to sit down in the yard right underneath the cell windows. The windows all have muzzles on them, and you can't look in. But from inside, hoarse, friendly voices advise, "Hey, fellows, you know what they do here? When they search you, they take away everything loose, like tea and tobacco. If you have any, toss it in here, through our window. We'll give it back later." So what do you know? We're suckers and rabbits. Maybe they do take tea and tobacco away. We have read about universal prisoner solidarity in all our great literature, that one prisoner won't deceive another. The way they spoke to us was friendly. "Hey, fellows!" And so we toss them our tobacco pouches. And the genuine, purebred thieves on the other side catch them and guffaw, "You fascist stupes!" And here are the slogans with which the whole transit prison welcomes us, even though they don't actually hang them on the walls. "Don't look for justice here. You're going to hand over everything you've got to us. You'll have to give it all up." This is repeated to you by the jailers, the convoy, and the thieves. You are overwhelmed by your unbearable prison term, and you are trying to figure out how to catch your breath, while everyone around you is figuring out how to plunder you. Everything works out so as to oppress the political prisoner, who is already depressed and abandoned without all that. "You will have to give it all up." The jailer at the Gorky Transit Prison shakes his head hopelessly, and with a sense of relief, Ernst Bernstein gives him his officer's greatcoat. Not free, but in exchange for 2 onions. And why should you complain about the thieves if you see all the jailers at Krasnaya Preznia wearing chrome leather boots they were never issued? They were all lifted by the thieves in the cells and then pushed to the jailers. Why complain about the thieves if the instructor of the cultural and educational department of the camp administration is a blatnoy, a thief himself, and writes reports on the politicals? The Chem Transit Prison. And how are you ever going to get justice against the thieves in the Rostov Transit Prison when this is their ancient native tribal den? They say that in 1942 at the Gorky Transit Prison, some officer prisoners, including Gavrilov, the military engineer Shchebitin, and others, nonetheless rebelled, beat up the thieves, and forced them to stay in line. But this is always regarded as a legend. Did the thieves capitulate in just one of the cells? For long? And how was it that the Blue Caps allowed the socially hostile elements to beat up the socially friendly ones? And when they say that at the Kotlas transit prison in 1940, the thieves started to grab money right out of the hands of the politicals lined up at the commissary, and the politicals began to beat them up so badly that they couldn't be stopped, and the perimeter guards entered the compound with machine guns to defend the thieves, now there's something that rings true. That's the way it really was. Foolish relatives. They dash about in freedom, borrow money, because they never have that kind of money at home, and send you foodstuffs and things, the widow's last mite, but also a poisoned gift because it transforms you from a free, though hungry, person into one who is anxious and cowardly, and it deprives you of that newly dawning enlightenment, that toughening resolve, which are all you need for your descent into the abyss.
This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.